60 feet. Not 600. Not 60,000. 60 feet above a dark reservoir in a Lancaster bomber, at 240 miles per hour, with anti-aircraft guns on the shoreline throwing tracer up at you, and a 2-ton drum-shaped bomb spinning backwards under the belly of the aircraft at 500 revolutions per minute. That was the mission. The altitude had to be exactly right, the speed had to be exactly right, the approach had to be exactly right, and if any one of those numbers slipped, the whole thing failed. Not failed like miss the target and try again on the next sortie, failed like the bomb skips the wrong direction or doesn't seat against the damn wall, or the Lancaster pulls up a half second too late and goes into the water. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and tonight on the Hangar, we're going back to May of 1943, to the Ruhr Valley, to the mission that put a word into the English language that pilots still recognize 60 years later. The damn busters, pull up a chair. This story takes a few minutes to get where it's going, but where it's going is worth the trip. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. To understand the operation, you have to understand the problem. The Ruhr Valley in 1943 was the engine room of Nazi Germany. Coal came out of it, steel went in, munitions, tanks, shell casings, machine parts, all of it flowed through the Ruhr. Cut the Ruhr, and you cut the Reich's ability to make war. The Royal Air Force had been bombing Ruhr targets for years. The factories kept producing. Part of what kept the Ruhr running was water. Three great dams controlled the river systems that fed the valley. The Moni Dam, completed in 1913, was the largest masonry dam in Europe. It held back more than 50 million tons of water in a reservoir that fed the canals, the cooling systems, the steel mills downstream. The Eder Dam controlled navigation, locks clear to the Rhine. The Sorp, Knock those dams down and the valley floods. The factories go dark. The canals run dry. The Germans are forced to divert enormous resources to rebuilding, resources they need somewhere else. The problem was physics. A dam is not a building. You cannot crater it the way you crater a factory. The masonry was too thick, too massive for any charge to breach the wall. It needed to be pressed against the face of the dam at the base, underwater, where the shockwave could transmit directly through the stone. No existing bomb, delivered by any existing method, could do that. Barnes Wallace thought he could. Now here's where it gets interesting. Barnes Wallace, in the spring of 1942, was 55 years old and had already made his mark on British engineering. The geodetic lattice structure inside the Wellington bomber was his design. So structurally redundant that Wellingtons came back from missions with sections of fuselage shot away that would have killed any other aircraft. He was an engineer's engineer, methodical, persistent, the kind of man who worked problems until they collapsed. He had also been thinking about something that looked on the surface like it belonged in a schoolyard. The way a spinning ball behaves on water, the backspin principle, hit the surface with spin on the ball and it will skip across the water. He had been running experiments, bouncing cylinders off a water tank, building mathematical models. What he saw was this: a spinning cylinder released at the correct speed and altitude would skip across a reservoir in a predictable arc, decelerate and sink when it finally hit a vertical surface. The backspin would then cause it to roll down that surface toward the base. At depth, a large enough charge would transmit a shockwave through the dam structure far beyond what any equivalent surface detonation could achieve. He called the weapon upkeep. Getting the Air Ministry to take it seriously was its own campaign. Wallace wrote papers. He ran more tests. He appealed to senior officers who appealed to other senior officers. The early presentations were met with skepticism bordering on dismissal. The Royal Air Force was fighting a war on multiple fronts. Finding time, resources, and specially modified aircraft for an untested weapon system that required a narrow delivery window, precise flight parameters, and a crew skill set that didn't yet exist, that was a hard sell. Several senior officers told him outright that it couldn't work. He kept pushing. he secured the attention of Lord Sherwell, the Prime Minister's scientific advisor. Full-scale prototype tests were arranged, bombs dropped from modified aircraft over open water. The weapons worked, the data was compelling. In February of 1943, with just under 4 months until the water levels would be right, the operation was approved. Now came the question of who was going to fly it. The answer was Wing Commander Guy Gibson. Gibson was 24 years old. 24. He had already completed over 70 bombing sorties and 70 night fighter missions. He was about to be pulled from combat for a rest tour, the standard rotation for aircrew who had done their time. Instead, he was offered one more mission, whatever aircraft and personnel he needed, and told only that it was special. He accepted. He handpicked his crews by going through the records of every Lancaster squadron in Bomber Command. He pulled the best men he could find, raiding other units for the crews with the instincts and the experience to do something unusual. They were told almost nothing about what that was. Security around Operation Chastise was absolute. Training began in March. Low-level flying over English lakes and reservoirs. Very low. These crews were accustomed to flying at 15,000 feet, 20,000 feet, in formation in the dark. Now they were being asked to come down to the surface, at speed, in the dark, and hold their altitude with a precision the altimeter alone couldn't provide. The solution was a pair of spotlights. Two lamps mounted under the belly of each Lancaster, angled so their beams would converge at a point on the water directly below, when the aircraft was at exactly 60 feet. As the bomber descended on the approach, the crew watched the two spots of light moving toward each other on the surface below. When they merged into a single figure eight of light, the pilot was at the right height. They trained for weeks. They flew over Derwent Water and Eyebrook Reservoir in the dark. They ran the approach again and again until the 60-foot altitude and the 240 airspeed became something a pilot could feel, not just read off instruments. At the same time, the Lancasters were being modified. Bomb bay doors removed, the mid-upper gun turret stripped out. The upkeep weapon hung in a special cradle mechanism underneath the aircraft that could spin it to the required speed before the drop. The ground crews who loaded them and the airmen who flew with them were working at the edge of everything they knew. The target window was narrow. The reservoirs needed to be at or near full capacity. That meant late spring. The full moon was required for any hope of visual navigation at low altitude over occupied territory. May was the month, the window a few nights at most. May 16, 1943. 19 Lancasters took off from RAF Scampton in Lincolnshire, organized into three waves, beginning just before 9:30 in the evening. The first wave of nine aircraft, led by Gibson, would strike the Monet Dam and then redirect to the Eder. The second wave of five would fly a separate route to the Sorp. The third wave would take off later as a mobile reserve. They flew south to the coast, then out over the North Sea, low enough that German radar couldn't find them. Moonlight on the wave tops visible through the Perspex nose, they crossed the Dutch coast and immediately began losing people. One aircraft from the second wave clipped an electricity pylon. The crew controlled it, barely, and turned back. Another hit the sea and went in. A third had the navigator's charts blown out through a hatch and navigated across Holland by memory. Two aircraft were gone before either main wave reached its target. Navigation at treetop height in the dark, across enemy territory, was an exercise in total concentration. The crews followed rivers and rail lines. They used church steeples and road intersections as waypoints. They flew between hills, over fields, at speeds that compressed reaction time to almost nothing. One uncharted power line, one gentle ridge in the darkness, and an aircraft that weighed 30 tons with a full fuel load and a spinning 2-ton bomb was going into the ground with no warning at all. The Monet Dam, Gibson came in first. He crossed the reservoir at 60 feet, the spotlight figure eight steady on the black water below, shore batteries opening up, tracer arching up in long curves across the approach. He held it, bomb released. The upkeep skipped three times across the reservoir, hit the wall, sank, and detonated. The explosion threw a column of water 1,000 feet into the air, enormous. And when the spray cleared, the dam was standing. Gibson circled and drew fire on himself while the second aircraft set up its run. He flew circles around the dam, full throttle, engines barking, making himself a target so the flak guns would track him instead of the bomber coming in on the water. The second aircraft hit the dam. Still it held. The third. The fourth one aircraft was shot down directly above the dam, flamed out on the approach, went in. Another took hits and had to abort. After the fifth aircraft dropped on the Monet, cracks appeared. After the sixth run, water was forcing through the wall. Then the dam gave way. Not a leak, a breach. The water came through as a wave, a moving wall of water 30 feet high, advancing down the valley at tremendous speed, taking bridges, buildings, power stations, roads. The flood wave traveled more than 30 miles before it exhausted itself. The Ruhr River ran brown for days. Gibson radioed the code word back to the operations room at Scampton. The officers there allowed themselves a moment. Then Gibson led the remaining aircraft to the Eater. The Eater approach was a different test entirely. The dam sat at the bottom of a valley that required a steep diving descent through a gap in the hills, a hard level off to get down to the surface over the water. A run at 60 feet down the valley, drop, and then an immediate pull up to clear the dam wall and the hills beyond. The wall was high. The hills were higher. The first pilot tried three times before finding the geometry. The second crew struggled as well. One pilot made six approaches before getting the release right. It took time that nobody had. But before the night was over, the Eater was breached. Two dams, both gone. When the surviving aircraft landed back at Scampton in the early morning hours of May 17th, Gibson began accounting for his people. 8 aircraft out of 19 did not return. 53 men were dead. 3 were taken prisoner. Of 133 airmen who had lifted off the evening before, 77 came home, a loss rate of over 40%. The crews who came back ate breakfast in the mess as the English morning came up. By all accounts, it was quiet in that room. There's not much to say after a night like that. The strategic effects of the Dambusters raid have been argued by historians ever since. The flooding of the Mooney Valley was real and significant, wrecking power stations, factories, roads, and bridges across a wide swath of the Ruhr. The disruption forced Germany to redirect substantial labor to repair work at a critical moment of the war. For a British public starving for good news, the raid was a triumph that echoed around the world. The German organization responded quickly. The dams were rebuilt within months. The SORP was never breached. Historians debate how much the operation truly shortened the war. The answers are complicated, as they always are. But 617 Squadron became something else entirely. A unit built for the impossible. Barnes Wallace went on designing larger weapons, the deep penetration bombs that became known as Tallboy and Grand Slam, designed to penetrate hardened structures that conventional bombs could never touch. 617 carried them. They sank the Tirpitz, the German battleship that had sheltered in a Norwegian fjord, threatening the Atlantic convoys for years. They destroyed U-boat pens, railway viaducts, underground rocket fuel plants. Every time a target seemed unreachable by ordinary means, the answer was 617. The squadron still flies today. They operate the F-35 Bravo. The Dambusters badge is still theirs. The motto in Latin translates as, "After me the flood." Gibson received the Victoria Cross. He was 24 years old. He continued to fly. He died in September of 1944 in a de Havilland mosquito that went down over the Netherlands under circumstances that have never been fully resolved. He had survived so much longer than anyone thought he would. Barnes Wallace, who had fought every bureaucratic resistance to get upkeep built, sat in his office when the casualty figures arrived. He is said to have felt the weight of every one of those 53 men deeply. He spent the rest of his long life building things that worked, things that saved lives more often than they cost them. He died in 1979 at 91 years old and never stopped working. Paul Brickhill's book, simply titled The Dambusters, remains the most complete account of the operation and the men who flew it. The RAF Museum holds the official records of 617 Squadron. The engineering records behind Wallace's upkeep weapon are in the archives of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. More at radiohangar.com. For the hangar, I'm Taildragger. 60 feet. Think about that the next time you're flying a stabilized approach and you're watching your altimeter with the runway coming up. 60 feet in the dark, under fire. Because that's what the mission required.